Hello, and welcome to the podcast for the November and December meetings for the Insurance Contracts Project. My name is Andrea Pride, and I'm here today with Daryl Scott to review the decisions that the Board has made over the last couple of months. Starting with the November meeting then, I think the main topic there being discussed was the discount rate for cash flows that are not subject to the mirroring approach, but which are nonetheless affected by asset returns. And I think what we've got there is a decision, one, a clarification of the principle we have for the discount rate in general, and another decision about how that affects the presentation between profit and loss and other comprehensive income. Daryl, would you like to comment on that?
Yes, thanks, Andrea. I think the clarification was really important because what we did was to clarify the principle that although discount rates for liabilities are determined taking account of the specific factors inherent in that liability, where the liability is linked to the assets, the factors of the assets are actually what are driving that discount rate determination. And the clarification was simply to clarify that when you do calculate or determine the discount rate that will be used for the liability, you need to take account of those asset-relevant factors. I think that's quite important because it was always a part of the intent of the Board, and many Board members in the discussion asked why we needed to clarify, but certainly it appears like there's been some misunderstanding in the application of that particular issue. The second issue was looking at the more complex type of insurance liabilities, those where you have a number of scenarios, some of which are asset dependent and some of which are not. And in essence, the Board decided that you need to be looking at each of those individual characteristics and determining which of the characteristics are asset dependent and determining a discount rate for those, and which are not asset dependent and determining the discount rate that is relevant to those. Finally, I think what was important in this whole decision was the fact that the rates need to be reset at the point in time that the insurer estimates or expects that future cash flows will be impacted by those changes in assets. And that means to a large extent that the effect of the assets being reset will be taken not through OCI for these asset-related UL-type contracts.
Okay. Also in the November meeting, we discussed presentation and disclosures, and really following on previous discussions, we provided drafting that illustrated how the presentation and disclosures would look in our new exposure draft. I think the main comment really I've got to make on the presentation requirements is that for the ISB, we're returning to a more principles approach following the IAS 1 requirements rather than specifying so much within the insurance contract standards what the line items should be. We also discussed a plan for fieldwork, and we'll update you as we develop that over time. Turning to last week's meeting now, the big topic of this month was the residual margin for participating contracts. And the Board decided by a very narrow majority that it would not take on some proposals that had been presented to us by a group of insurance preparers.
Yeah, Andrea, this was a fairly lengthy debate at the Board table, and I think what we were trying to get our heads around is an understanding where you have a participating contract relationship or participating contract, specifically in order to meet our definition of participating contracts, there needs to be a contractual relationship between the performance of the underlying assets and the amount that is due to the policyholders. That relationship effectively divides up the performance of the underlying assets between a component that is attributable to the policyholders and a component that is attributable to the insurer themselves. The discussion centered around how to treat that component that is attributable to the insurer. The industry proposals largely wanted to regard that component attributable to the insurer as being part of an overall contract, in other words, looking at the contract as a single whole. A view that was expressed by, I think, the majority of Board members, and as you mentioned, it was a bare majority, was the view that, in fact, that component attributable to the insurer is attributable to the insurer. It's their return on their portion of the underlying assets. And consequently, in reaching the decision we did, the Board viewed that as being separate from the underlying insurance contract and being therefore necessary to be carried through profit and loss in the normal way that any other return on insurer's assets would be treated. It's, as I say, a fairly long discussion that the Board had on the topic, and I think a very narrow vote, and certainly one where we had some sympathy with the concerns expressed by industry, but where we felt that we couldn't actually meet or address those concerns without having a fairly significant effect on the underlying integrity of our model.
Yes, I think it's always difficult because one of the axioms the board's been working with is that the insurance contract liability is separate from the assets held to back the insurance contract. However, in the case of a participating contract, the waters are muddied a little because the point of a participating contract is to pass through some of those asset returns to the policyholder, and the contract needs to be looked a little bit more as a whole. However, some discomfort was expressed at the board table about you know, creating a new model almost, about consistency with non-participating contracts, and about whether this really just takes us a little bit too far away from what we had intended to do when we set out on this project. The other main topic, I think, in the December meeting was to do with the impairment requirements and how they might apply to reinsurance contracts. Back in early 2011, the board had decided that it would like to use the general requirements of IFRS 9 impairment proposals to apply to the reinsurance contract as well. However, since then, there have been developments in the insurance contracts project, with notably the unlocking of the residual margin, and there have been developments in the impairment project. And the purpose of the paper was really to bring all those decisions together and sort of perform a sense check to see whether the outcome was something that would be desirable by the board. So the decision that the boards came to was that we would keep reinsurance contracts within the insurance contract standard. We wouldn't look to another standard to measure the impairment part of it. But unlike the treatment of most cash flows, changes in expected credit losses would be recognised in profit and loss rather than as an offset to residual margin.
Andrea, the discussion here really revolved around two core decisions from the board perspective. The first one was whether or not we would use the impairment model within the insurance model to determine the impairment of these particular assets. And I think the view that the board felt very strongly about in this space was that the impairment model as it exists at the moment as it is proposed at the moment in IFRS 9, is primarily targeted at dealing with with amortized cost assets. It's a model based on the fact that the underlying cash flows and the underlying discount rates are not reset on an ongoing basis, and hence it tries to take into account what would happen if those had been reset and determine what an impaired amount would be. The concern with that approach, though, is that effectively, because current information is not generally maintained in these sorts of environments, the model is a fairly blunt instrument to accommodate operational concerns. When we were dealing with reinsurance assets, the board felt very strongly that a lot of the current up-to-date information is in fact available, and that to use a model like that to operate in a current value situation would actually not be particularly appropriate. And we felt that the fact that the insurance standard as it is proposed at the moment requires you to update all these values meant that there were better ways to actually get to the appropriate number, and hence the decision to actually stay within the insurance standard. The second part of the discussion revolved around what do we do with that deterioration in credit once it's recognised. And initially the staff paper proposed that would be put into the unlocked residual margin, would be absorbed in the unlocked residual margin. But I think the board's view in this space was that credit impairment is not part of the general credit risks that are taken into account when entering into a reinsurance contract, and we felt that this was something that a user of financial statements would find useful as a separate information. And consequently, we took the decision to actually not take it through the unlocked margin, but rather reflect it in profit and loss as it happened.
Okay, so we also provided at the meeting, as is our custom, an update on the activities of the FASB as they carry on with the FASB-only decisions that they require for their exposure draft. And unusually, there was just one question this time on the treatment of mutuals. Would you like to comment on that?
Yep, thanks, Andrea. Our understanding of what the FASB has decided in regard mutuals is that to the extent that an amount is not expected to be paid out to policyholders, that amount can actually be treated as equity in the hands of the mutual. On the face of it, this sounds very consistent with the decisions we've taken up to this date, that in essence, you need to create a liability for all of the estimated payments that you're going to make to policyholders, and anything else obviously has to go to equity. So we would probably agree in context or in principle with what the FASB has decided. For many of our board members, though, discussing this, it seems difficult to imagine the circumstances in which a mutual does not have an obligation to pay out funds to the policyholder, either current or future policyholders. And so although we would probably agree in principle with the FASB's decision, we're not at this stage seeing any circumstances where it would be applicable. I think what is going to be important for us here is to keep monitoring, as we normally do, the decisions of the FASB and see where this actually evolves to.
Okay, so looking a little bit further ahead then, past the holiday break, the project team are planning to wind up deliberations over the next couple of months. We're expecting to do most of the sweep issues in January and probably focus on the due process papers in February. And after that, we'll be working on drafting to try and publish an exposure draft during the first half of 2013. So I think with that, then all that remains for me to say is happy holidays. Thanks for your interest in the insurance contracts project over the last year or so. And we hope that you will carry on being interested in it as we go through 2013. Happy holidays.